Hello and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. And it's good to be back today with another interview for you. This time with somebody who really doesn't need that much of an introduction from me. The man who, for the best part of 30 years, accompanied Bowie live and in the studio with his incredibly distinctive sound and sensibility, the pianist extraordinaire, Mike Garson. So from playing with the Spiders from Mars in 72, to improvising that most extraordinary of passages of pop music history, that completely frenetic piano solo in Aladdin Sane, and then onto the elegance of 2003's Reality, Garson was, I think, the only musician to have played with Bowie across the decades, sculpting the sound for Aladdin Sane, Pinups, Diamond Dogs, Young Americans, Black Tie White Noise, Outside, Earthling, Heathen, and Reality. And as he explains here, he was only originally hired for 8 weeks. Having said that, I know Earl Slick has also played for decades too, but yeah, it's a very small number of people, isn't it? So anyway, I had 30 minutes to speak with him recently, and given that exceptional history he had with Bowie, we earlier obviously had one album to discuss, so unsurprisingly, we went for the most obvious choice, Aladdin Sane. The track itself became very much the focus of our conversation. I really wanted to find out how he felt when he made that track and what went into the improvisational process. As he says, he was a jazz musician. He didn't really know very much about Bowie before he started playing with him. Anyway, so it's a pleasure to share this one with you. It's a short interview, but I hope you enjoy it. It's Mike Garson. Here we go.
You know, the bizarre thing is that I was only hired for 8 weeks.
Only 8 weeks?
I was hired for 8 weeks.
How did he come to hire you?
1972, 8 weeks. Absolutely bizarre, because I didn't know who David Bowie was. I didn't know any of the guys from the Spiders. I didn't know his music. I was a jazz musician, classical musician, avant-garde musician, composer, piano teacher, all the normal things a musician does. And I knew nothing about the concept of a famous person, no less a genius Renaissance famous special person named David. And, you know, there was a short tour. It was the first Ziggy Stardust tour when they came to America. And only David would not come to America with a piano player. I mean, and he's doing Life on Mars and Changes. I mean, that's a little spacey in itself. And he knew a lady named Annette Peacock, who was a very interesting avant-garde singer. And I had just a few months earlier played on her album called I'm the One. So he ran into her and said, do you happen to know a piano player? But in actual fact, before he said that, he asked her to join the band. Now, she's a decent pianist, but she really had her own career and a singer, and she's like a very poetic type of an artist. She really didn't want to tour, and she really didn't have the skill set to do what I was going to do. So she recommended me, you know, it was this short tour, 8 weeks, you want to join? And we liked each other, and we liked how we co-created music together, and the rest is history.
Annette Peacock would have been fascinating. I have that album of hers. I think it's from 79, Survival. And it's very free form and very experimental. It would have been a very intriguing proposition for her to have played with him. But she introduced you to Bowie then.
So the album that I played on with her was called I'm the One.
Yeah.
Mick Ronson from the Spiders on Mix albums, he recorded the song, and I played it for him too on piano, as well as having done it for Annette. And that resonated very much so with David. So it took me 20 years to figure out who recommended me for the gig. I didn't know. So for years, there was this recording engineer that was taking the credit, and he said, no, I was the one who connected. He happened to have been the recording engineer on the date, but David didn't know him, and it was Annette, because he respected Annette, and so did Mick Ronson respect Annette, you know. So it was like, I guess it was meant to be, but I'm still perplexed how it all turned out, because I'm not a rock musician. and David Bowie in 1973 in one of your London papers, I can't remember if it was The Guardian or The Times or what it was, on a Sunday morning on the top page of the art section, I wake up to this. I was living in England at the time in Sussex, and I wake up to it and it says, Mike Garson is the best pianist in the world. Mike Garson is the best rock pianist in the world because he doesn't play rock. I mean, a perfect David Bowie statement. And it's sort of the next thing was to do the Aladdin Sane album, which would have been like 50 years in January when we started to record it. So in 3 months, it'll be 50 years. I'll probably do a few special shows during that year because I do love that music. I mean, I was tormented on what album to pick because I played on about 19 of them, and I love Outside tremendously. I love Diamond Dogs tremendously. I love Young Americans. And then there's a slew of albums that I'm not on that I adore, such as Black Star. And then you jump back to Hunky Dory and Ziggy. So, and Reality is a terrific album, would bring me to Disco King and Loneliest Sky. So I was suffering, but I figured, in real honesty, the thing that put me on the map and let people sort of into my world was that album, because Ziggy was so guitar heavy, as you know, and in the best sense of the word. And David was one of these guys who could run out something, as you know, very fast. So Ziggy tour and the Ziggy period should have gone on another 6 months, a year or two. David stops it. We do the next thing. David stops it. Do the next thing. He's on to the next thing. So he was ready. He recognized my piano playing, which was very cool. And he gave me the space and the vision to be who I wanted to be. And it was almost like he was like a surgeon and went into my brain, and anything I had practiced the prior 20 years, he found on Time, he found on Lady Grinning Soul, he found on Aladdin Sane, he found on Let's Spend the Night Together. I mean, I'd have to say that David would be the ultimate casting director, because anyone who would come, let's say 90% of anyone who came in his radar or aura was the perfect person. Mick Ronson, Carlos Alomar. You mentioned Donnie McClassen on Black Star, Earl Slick, Sterling Campbell, Jerry Leonard, Gail Ann Dorsey, Woody, Trevor. When I say the ultimate casting director, he must have done his research. He would listen. He would ask questions. And once you arrived in his space, he let you do what you do best. You take Carlos on Fame to put that whole groove down, coming from an English rock band like the Spiders to do that, to have me play so out there on Aladdin Sane and accept that to go on a record. And there has not been a day in 30 years since the internet, so to speak, where I don't get a communication on that one solo. Don't ask me why. I've played on thousands of dates, thousands of musicians, hundreds of tracks with David, 600 live albums, live shows with David, 600. And the only thing anyone talks about is Aladdin Sane. Once in a while, Lady Grinning Soul, and once in a while, Time. And it wasn't even my choice to play that solo. I played a blues solo and David said no. And I played a Latin solo and David said no. He said, play that wild stuff you played in New York City in the jazz clubs and that avant-garde stuff. I literally said to him, that's exactly why I'm not working on the weekends, because I play like that. And he said, I love it, just do it. And that it was one take, and I never heard the track for, I don't know, 10 to 15 years maybe.
Well, okay, let's drill down on this, because like you quite rightly say, people recognize that solo as being one of the most iconic moments in rock music. It's an extraordinary thing, that solo. I can hear it all in my head right now as I talk to you. It's just something otherworldly. Let's talk about the mundane recording of it. I mean, do you remember the day, the session when you recorded that track? Do you remember how you prepared, that kind of thing? I would be absolutely fascinated to hear about.
I'm glad to share, because it was a big pleasure moment in my life. And it was my first album with him. And I was used to sort of recording in studios that didn't have the quality of Trident. Trident Studio, the Beatles recorded, Queen, you know, there's a piano in there called a Bechstein piano. It's a European grand piano that you couldn't play a wrong note on it. It was so beautiful and sweet. And having Ken engineer it and get the perfect sound, and thinking that Paul and John and Freddie all played on that instrument, I mean, I felt like I was cheating. You couldn't play a wrong note. The notes were in the piano, they were in the walls, they were in the keys. So I just sat down and fell in love with the piano. And, you know, that is my instrument. You know, a saxophone has to worry about the reeds, and a vocalist makes sure he has enough tea and honey to keep his voice good and not to talk too much before a show. My thing is, obviously, I have to have fingers that are prepared and drilled my whole life through repetition. But really, the instrument is so important to me. A trumpet player, a sax player travels with their instrument. Some pianists, maybe very famous and rich, could travel with a grand piano, but not me. So I was blessed to have this special piano. It was the first album that I was playing on for David. And he had made a decision, obviously, that this is going to be focused around Mike and the piano. So I'm mixed so loud. If you listen to me on many tracks on other albums, with Nine Inch Nails, Smashing Pumpkins, other Bowie, the piano is in its right place. Here, like, I'm the lead guitarist on a piano, which is insane. But only David could get away with it. And to convince people through his magic and his intention that this belongs on a rock album 50 years ago, it would be out there today.
It is out there. It is completely out there. It's like I said, it's like it's been beamed in from outer space. Yeah. Solo. So I can't imagine in 1973 the impact that must have had. But so you're at this piano, and like you say, it's a piano with magic inside it. I mean, I remember reading that Paul McCartney used to love, I think they did Hey Jude in Trident. They did a few sessions in 68, 69 in Trident, and they loved it because it was, again, there was something about that setup. But okay, so you had
the track. You remember this, right? There you go, right?
I wasn't expecting that in our conversation. That's fantastic.
I'm sitting right here. I don't move from this area too much.
I don't blame you.
My wife could attest to that. I'm upstairs, downstairs, and I'm in my studio banging away all the time.
She knows where to find you.
She knows where to find me. Most of the time she calls me.
So you're at the piano, and so David had a track more or less in place. The song was more or less structured, and this is when you come in and it's like, okay, can you do a solo? And you said you ran through a blues solo, you went through a kind of Latin solo, and they weren't working out. To you as a jazz musician, what was your relationship with David's music? I mean, you've been playing it on the road, but in your jazz bones, how are you finding it fitting in with a rock band and a rock recording setup?
Well, I wasn't a rock musician and I don't know too much rock and roll. For a show I'm doing tomorrow night, I just learned a Kink song, you know.
Oh, which one?
Celluloid.
Okay, nice.
That one, right? Yeah, and I'm performing. Yeah. Then I learned a T-Rex song, a Cosmic Dancer. I mean, I know all that, but I know Miles Davis and John Coltrane songs and Green Dolphin Street and All Blues and Love Supreme. So here I'm in this space I'm given a canvas and this guy is saying, draw whatever you want on it. So anything, as I said before, that I had studied, you look at time, right? That comes from a certain period of time in the 20s or 30s.
It's very cabaret, very...
Very cabaret.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I would do things like... crazy little runs that instead of being a straight run, I put in a little dissonant. And then, you know, so I had a combination of avant-garde, we call it stride piano from back in the day. It was things like, so it was that, but twisted for David. Then you have the music of, Rachmaninoff, Franz Liszt, Chopin, and all of a sudden they give me Lady Grinning Soul, and I go, I mean, how different is that then? So it was like this guy had these forceps plunging into my head and pulling out anything I ever thought about. We're talking about me channeling this music through his vision and whatever the angels wanted to come out, because I could tell you it had nothing to do with me. The only thing I had done is shown up and practiced 100,000 hours before I got there. But other than that, I just surrendered, got out of the way, and played. And because it was exciting, and they were supportive. Now, what I left out is the unsung hero there was Mick Ronson.
A fantastic arranger, a fantastic producer.
Yeah, a string writer.
Yeah, yeah.
My friend, we would have dinner every night, and he played the piano, and he picked my brain, and he was wise, and he would put such a great guitar part on, whether it was like acoustic Spanish on Lady Grinning Soul or a hard guitar. You couldn't play a wrong note when you have the Spiders and Mix laying down just a beautiful beat. Every song that I played for, they played the right thing. So I was sort of the whipped cream on the cake, and whatever I played on top never took away from that rock groove. So I didn't change them into a jazz band or a cabaret band or a classical band. I was just some crazy, secret sauce that was put on top of the pizza, you know, with a lot of sugar in it that made it interesting. You know, it worked without me as a straight rock band, but David and RCA and management and all that, they must have seen that this could be interesting. And that takes a lot of balls on their part.
It's more than just the whipped cream on top. You very much shaped that thing, which I know would have resonated so deeply with Bowie, you know, his love of 1920s cabaret and theater, and that very dark side you bring with those slurred notes, dark, menacing feel. I think that must have thrilled him.
He did have a smile on his face, I can tell you that. You know, I'm a ham, so if I have an audience of three or four, which there was in that recording room, and I could feel them, I'll give 120%. If I have people who are being judgmental, what the hell is he playing? I won't even be at zero. I'll be like minus 40. I'll play terrible because I'm an artist and I'm vulnerable to the space and I'm an improviser. So I play, everyone's included in those notes. I'm the representative, but I'm taking in the collective this of that consciousness of that space and the zeitgeist of 73 and Ziggy. And I was in the right place at the right time. And that's why it's such a monumental solo, because I did some, like a scientist, I did some tests on the David Live album. I played a solo on Aladdin Sane, and I had known that the other solo was liked. I played even more notes and crazier, and in 50 years, no one has ever mentioned that solo. So why? You see what I'm saying? So I don't know the answer to that, because music goes much deeper than the rules of music, which are rhythm, harmony, and melody. You need that, just like when we speak English together or any language, those are your words, but it's the intention behind the notes and whatever else is supporting you in that endeavor. So it was all these coordinates meeting. It's like you go see a great movie and Meryl Streep just blows you away. And we talk about it for 20 years. What about the 1,000 people that led to that space to make that happen, and the directors and the stage people and the lighting guy and the sound guy and her assistant and the person who makes the food? I had all that as a support system under me. Mind you, I didn't know any of this when I was in my 20s, 50 years ago. But you're asking a question, looking back, this is how it transpired, and I'm forever grateful. And since David has left us, I mean, my career just keeps soaring, because the further away from his death, the more legendary and mystical listen, he probably is the greatest artist of that century and into this century. You know, for a while I was thinking it was this. No, his talent was producer, singer, songwriter, artist, sculptor, editor of an art magazine, humorist, I mean, fashion person. It's never philosopher. It never ends with him. You hear his voice and his statements in Moon Age Daydream, and you hear the body of work, and that only is capturing 10% of what this guy did and what he could have done, you know. So I'm in awe of him. And so I didn't see him as just a rock musician, to answer your early question. When I joined, I knew he was a Renaissance guy. And I slipped out to the audience on those early Ziggy Stardust shows, because I didn't play every song. So they'd be doing Width of a Circle or a tune that I didn't play piano on. I'd sneak into the first row, because those shows were not even sold out. Nobody knew who he was in America. So I'd go in the first row and look up and see this guy, and I said, this is the Miles Davis of the rock world. I like him. I'm going to contribute to him and play my best. And that's what happened.
You mentioned earlier about the zeitgeist of 1973. Could you expand on that a little bit and just tell us what it was to you? What was the zeitgeist of 1973?
I didn't know it. I could say it, tell you in retrospect. I was aware that in the 60s, the Beatles created some amazing effect worldwide and still exists. I was aware that Bob Dylan created some amazing effects. I was aware of Led Zeppelin, you know. And then this guy comes out with a whole new angle on music. And it must have been a needed and wanted commodity. If you think about today, with binary and non-binary, LGBT, all of that, he made it safe and led the way for it 50 years ago. He's the guy that made it safe for anyone to be who they are and what they want to be. People at that time, you know, saw him as a freak, and the reviews and the things, and oh my God, my jazz musicians friends, they never stopped making fun of me and teasing me. And I said, you'll see one day, you know.
We only have a few minutes left, but I was very keen to talk to you about Moon Age Daydream. And I was just curious. I mean, you mentioned earlier that it was only a small percentage of the man and his artistic vision and his achievements was in that film. And that's pretty much what Brett said as well. He said that, how could I have covered everything in one movie? It'd be impossible.
Brett couldn't cover it all, but he needs 50 hours and 10 parts to the movie. I saw a lot of cuts. I saw a lot of scenes that had to be taken out because it was way over 3-4 hours. So he had to keep cutting. So obviously some people were disappointed. Maybe they'll show up on YouTube. The point is, he could have done it. You just need a 10-part series of 2 hours each one. But he did a fantastic job of having the music mixed in a fantastic way. Wonderful quotes and wisdom of David. You get a certain insight into the guy, and visually it's pretty astounding, and how he would do almost mashups of things and
pieces
from this era and this era and mixed in. And I mean, my hat's off to him, and the dedication that Brett had to this project. I watched it over a 5 or 6 year period. The poor guy had a heart attack and was pronounced dead, and came through it and still continued. And he had wonderful support from the estate, and he had thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of access. So this guy just saw everything. And every once in a while, he'd call me in over the years. What do you think of this? Do you remember this? Well, naturally, I remember because I was on stage. Like, for example, he said, do you remember Rock and Roll with me in Buffalo? And I did. And he played it for me. You know, people are going to go crazy when they see it. Why are you not going crazy? Well, I played it that day, you know, you know, but it is a nice memory, you know. And
you see, we as fans, we are, you know, we look at you and just think, gosh, what's it been like to have stood by Bowie, to have worked with him, collaborated with him, exchanged ideas with him, inspired him, turned him on, created this music. And so Brett's film, I think, for many of us, is one of the closest experiences, this sort of multi-layered dynamic experience.
He invited me to a streaming. There were four of us in the big IMAX theater watching it, and it was overwhelming. And my hat was off to him, and I told him so. And to be with David and hang with him and have him as a friend and discuss music was a dream come true and miraculous. But to be honest with you, the conversations were no different than what we're doing now. He was just a guy that liked to talk and tell stories and laugh and pick your head. He asked me more about my music than I asked him about his, which, you talk about humility. I mean, he's David Bowie. I'm some guy that I'd still be in fucking jazz club making $5 a night if it wasn't for him. I'd be happy, but I'd have no money and I'd have no career. This guy is responsible for that. And from the other side, he's still pushing me forward and helping me out, you know? So what a catalyst for my career. So I'm indebted to him. But to be honest with you, if I never met the guy and I just heard his music and saw his films, he's, for me, the greatest artist of that century. And we're going to find out more of that as the years go on. And there are so many tracks I recorded with him that never have been released. And you know, a lot has been released, but there's more, because I was always jamming with him, always playing, always fooling around. We'd be at the piano and fooling around and making music. You know, he was a musician. The reason he didn't do more films is he actually liked playing music more. He was a great actor and he did enjoy it, but not as much as music. You know, David Bowie, a multimillionaire, great artist, 1995, we play some festival in Europe, don't know where, 100,000 people, fantastic. And what does David say to us after the show? He says, we're going over to a rave down the road. Nobody's going to know us. I'm going to play the baritone saxophone, that's the big one, and we're going to jam on the outside music, but without me singing. And the lights will be dim and I'll be in a disguise and we'll just play. After a show, in the middle of a tour. Nobody videoed that. Nobody knows that happened. But the memory is instilled in my
mind. And you all went and did it?
We went and did it. And I would play crazy solos for 20 minutes with drum beats and bass and David honking away on the horn.
If only those ravers had known what was going on.
They were on ecstasy. How would they know anything? So we played it for an hour and left. And to this day, nobody knows it happened. I don't think I've shared that story but once or twice. By the way, that was one of the best bands. It was Reeves.
Yes. Myself, yes.
Gail Ann Dorsey and Zach Alfred. When I say one of the best bands in terms of freeness and improvising, we had every band, I worked with 13 bands with David, but every great band every band was great, but this one had a certain free magic when we traveled around. And Reeves was partially responsible for bringing me back in the band when I was back in the jazz world in the 80s. He said to David, you got to get Mike back in. And that's when I rejoined for Black Tie White Noise. But he's the culprit.
But we must have an episode one time with you and Reeves chatting talking about the 90s.
I will now, tell you one thing that you will get a kick out of. That son of a bitch waited to the end of the tour to tell me this. And at the end of the tour, Reeves says, do you know when I was in the sixth grade, I was good at art and I made a picture of who I wanted to play with when I grew up, and it was you and David.
And he waited till the end of the tour to tell you that.
Maybe it was good for my head.
Oh my God, that's brilliant. Perfect. Mike, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute joy talking to you. We'll do another one.
I love that you know so much about him. That makes me happy.
Well, it's just a joy to speak with you. Thank you.
Mike Gosselin, yeah.
And that was Mike Garson talking to me, and I'm really grateful to him for his time and generosity in sharing those memories with us, and hopefully we'll have more from him in the future. Okay, so that's it for this episode. Thank you as ever for listening, for all your reactions and kind comments to the Brett Morgan episode. And that's it for me. Take care and bye for now.